we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
I have seen so much malnutrition here. I've seen it in the pregnancies that we see. I've seen it in the babies that come out. I've seen it walking through the emergency room with the kids and the men and women. So I see it everywhere. I see it in the staff who every day talk about how hungry they are.
Gaza officials say Israel's killed at least 111 Palestinians over the past 24 hours, including 91 seeking food and aid. We'll speak with a doctor just back from Gaza. Meanwhile, Israel's blaming the United Nations for withholding aid to Gaza.
This is a monument to the catastrophic failure of the United Nations to deliver aid into Gaza. Hundreds upon hundreds of pallets of aid just rotting in the sun instead of being delivered to the people who need it.
We'll get an update on UN aid efforts in Gaza from Julia Tuma, spokesperson for UNRWA, the UN Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees. And finally, as Trump's tariff deadline looms, where do things stand on trade agreements?
August 1st is a very big day for this country because money is going to pour into the United States like we've never seen before.
Trump hits India with 25% tariffs and Brazil with 50% tariffs for putting his ally, former President Bolsonaro, on trial for attempting a coup in Brazil. Trump also threatened Canada's trade deal for backing a Palestinian state. We'll speak with Lori Wallach, director of Rethink Trade. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Officials in Gaza say Israel's killed at least 111 Palestinians over the past 24 hours, including 91 people seeking food and aid. Over 800 Palestinians have been injured. In the deadliest incident on Wednesday, at least 51 were killed by Israeli forces as they headed toward aid trucks at the Zikim crossing. On Wednesday, Palestinians gathered at El Shifa Hospital to mourn the deaths of family and friends killed on Tuesday while seeking aid.
You can ask anyone. For 3 or 4 days, you couldn't find any food. People were either dying of hunger, even in intensive care units, you find them starving with nothing to eat. Or we would die in the places of death, the places of killing and destruction, where we go to get something to eat but end up bringing back our children to bury them.
On Wednesday, Canada became the latest country to announce plans to recognize a Palestinian state, joining recent calls by France and the UK. Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney spoke in Ottawa.
Canada intends to recognize the state of Palestine at the 80th session of the United Nations General Assembly in September 2025. This intention is predicated on the Palestinian Authority's commitment to much-needed reforms, including commitments by the Palestinian Authority's President Abbas to fundamentally reform its governance, to hold general elections in 2026 in which Hamas can play no part, and to demilitarize the Palestinian state.
Israel blasted Canada's move, calling it a, quote, reward for Hamas. President Trump wrote on Truth Social, quote, that will make it very hard for us to make a trade deal with them, unquote. Meanwhile, Trump's special envoy, Steve Witkoff, has arrived in Israel as ceasefire talks have stalled. In the UK, a high court has ruled the co-founder of the direct action group Palestine Action can challenge the Home Secretary's decision to ban the group as a terrorist organization. Under the ban, membership and direct support of Palestine Action is punishable by up to 14 years in prison. Since it was banned, more than 200 people have been arrested for publicly protesting in support of Palestine Action. That includes an 83-year-old priest and an 81-year-old retired magistrate judge. Meanwhile, the Board of Deputies of British Jews, the largest organization representing Jews in the UK, has called for a, quote, massive and sustained flow of aid into Gaza. The organization also condemned Israel's starving of the population of the besieged strip. It comes as Prime Minister Keir Starmer announced the UK will recognize a Palestinian state unless Israel agrees to a ceasefire. On Capitol Hill, more than half the Democratic caucus voted Wednesday to block $675 million in U.S. arms sales to Israel. Senator Bernie Sanders had introduced the measure, which ended up being defeated in a 70-27 vote. Senator Sanders spoke from the floor before the vote.
The United States has provided more than $22 billion for Israel's military operations since this war began. $22 billion. One estimate based on Brown University research calculates that the United States has paid for 70% of the Gaza war. In other words, American taxpayer dollars are being used to starve children, bomb schools, kill civilians, and support the cruelty of Netanyahu and his criminal ministers.
The U.S. has sanctioned Alexandre de Moraes, the Brazilian Supreme Court justice, in charge of the criminal case against the right-wing former President Jair Bolsonaro, accused of attempting a coup after losing the 2022 elections. The U.S. also slapped Brazil with 50% tariffs on imports. President Trump signed an executive order announcing the tariffs, specifically citing the justice for abusing, quote, his judicial authority to target political opponents, end quote. President Trump has expressed his admiration for Bolsonaro in the past, calling his trial a witch hunt. Bolsonaro is often referred to as the Trump of the tropics. In other trade news, Trump has announced 25% tariffs on India and new penalties against India for purchasing Russian oil. Trump also announced a new trade deal with South Korea, setting the tariff rate at 15%. We'll have more on Trump's trade deals later in the broadcast. After a historic trial, former Colombian president, close U.S. ally Álvaro Uribe, has been convicted of witness tampering and bribery. He'll be sentenced Friday and faces up to 12 years in prison. The case centered on efforts by Uribe to bribe imprisoned members of paramilitary groups to retract damaging testimony exposing his ties to right-wing paramilitary groups. Uribe ruled Colombia from 2002 to 2010. U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio criticized Uribe's conviction. In Texas, Republican state lawmakers have formally introduced a plan to redraw Texas's congressional districts with the goal of picking up five more Republican seats. The Texas Republican Party has called the effort a, quote, essential step to preserving GOP control in Congress, unquote. Democratic Congressmember Greg Kassar said the GOP gerrymandering will result in the, quote, illegal voter suppression of Black and Latino Texans. Under the plan, Kassar's district would be redrawn. Meanwhile, California's Democratic Governor Gavin Newsom is pushing to counter Texas by redrawing California's congressional maps to add more Democratic seats. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent has admitted a new Trump plan to create savings accounts for newborns is actually a backdoor way to privatize Social Security. Bessent made the comment Wednesday during a forum organized by the right-wing news outlet Breitbart.
I'm not sure when the distribution level date should be, whether should it be 30 and you can buy a house, should it be 60, but in a way, it is a backdoor for privatizing Social Security.
Democratic Senator Jeanne Shaheen of New Hampshire responded by saying, quote, they're already ripping health care away from millions on Medicaid, and now they've made it clear that your Social Security is next, unquote. In other economic news, the Federal Reserve voted Wednesday to hold interest rates steady, defying pressure from President Trump, who visited the Fed last week to personally lobby for lower rates. In a rare move, two Republicans on the Fed dissented, expressing support for lowering rates. During a news conference, Fed Chair Jerome Powell emphasized the importance of the Fed remaining independent. Trump has repeatedly publicly attacked Powell, calling him a total and complete moron and a numbskull, as well as a disaster. A Senate committee has advanced a bill banning stock trading by members of Congress, the president and the vice president. President Trump slammed the lone Republican who voted for the bill, Missouri Senator Josh Hawley, calling him a, quote, second-tier senator, unquote. That's despite a carve-out Hawley added to the bill that would exclude President Trump. The bill would require elected officials to divest from their stocks at the beginning of their next term and would apply to the president and the vice president starting in 2029. The bill faces steep odds in the Republican-controlled Senate. Harvard's prepared to pay up to $500 million to settle two federal lawsuits brought by the Trump administration. That's according to the New York Times, which reports the emerging deal would unfreeze billions of dollars of frozen funds for research grants and contracts while preserving Harvard's ability to enroll international students. This comes just days after Columbia University agreed to a $221 million settlement after Trump threatened to cut off federal funding, accusing administrators of failing to protect Jewish students against anti-Semitism during campus protests against Israel's assault on Gaza. Meanwhile, Brown University said Wednesday it's agreed to a $50 million settlement that'll restore federal funding for medical research. Brown agreed to comply with the Trump administration's demands to end the consideration of race in its admissions policies. It'll also enforce a ban on transgender athletes in women's sports. Meanwhile, the Trump administration's freezing $108 million in federal research funding to Duke University after determining its affirmative action policies constitute racial discrimination. In California, immigration officials at San Francisco International Airport have detained a South Korean-born researcher and longtime permanent resident for the past week without explanation and without access to a lawyer. Taehyung Will Kim moved to the U.S. when he was just 5 years old. He's a doctoral candidate at Texas A&M University, where he's working on a vaccine to prevent Lyme disease. He was detained July 21st after returning from a two-week trip to South Korea to attend his brother's wedding. A federal appeals court has rejected the Trump administration's bid to rearrest Columbia University graduate Palestinian activist Mahmoud Khalil while the government appeals his release on bail. Wednesday's ruling by the Third Circuit Court of Appeals also affirms a lower court ruling that the Trump administration cannot seek to deport Khalil over his lawful First Amendment-protected speech in support of Palestinian rights. Mahmoud Khalil is a U.S. permanent resident married to a U.S. citizen. New York's Democratic mayoral nominee, Sohrab Mamdani, is calling for a nationwide ban on assault rifles, like the one used by the gunman who opened fire Monday on the Manhattan high-rise that houses the NFL's headquarters. After returning from Uganda, where he celebrated his wedding, Mamdani visited the Bronx home of Didarul Islam, the New York police officer who was killed in Monday's mass shooting. Speaking to reporters after meeting with Islam's family, Mamdani distanced himself from a call he made in 2020 to defund the police and accused his opponents of politicizing the shooting.
And what I would also say in this moment is that it is beyond me that politicians are looking to use these days to score such cynical political points. On the very day that I held the father of Officer Islam in my arms, as he could not utter a single word, and as I felt him sobbing at the memory of his 36-year-old son, who will never come home.
Ukrainian officials say Russian drones and missiles struck the capital, Kyiv, overnight, killing at least 8 people, wounding dozens of others, including a 6-year-old boy. Russia's attack came hours after Ukraine's parliament voted to restore the independence of two anti-corruption agencies following widespread protests and pressure from European officials. Thousands demonstrated in the streets after President Zelensky's ruling party tried to push amendments that would have allowed his administration to transfer cases away from the agencies. And Israel's released U.S. labor activist Chris Smalls and the Tunisian activist Hatem Ayouini. They had been detained on Saturday with 19 others with the Freedom Flotilla Coalition when Israeli forces raided their Gaza-bound aid ship, the Handala, in international waters. Earlier this week, the Freedom Flotilla Coalition revealed Smalls had been beaten in Israeli detention. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Nermeen Sheikh. Welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world. Palestinian health officials in Gaza say Israeli attacks have killed at least 111 people and injured more than 800 others just in the past 24 hours. Among the dead are 91 people killed while seeking aid. Meanwhile, Al Jazeera reports a young Palestinian man from Rafah has died from starvation, the 155th hunger-related death since Israel began its assault and siege on Gaza nearly 2 years ago. This week, the world's leading hunger monitoring system warned the, quote, worst-case scenario of famine is playing out in the Gaza Strip, with widespread starvation, malnutrition, and disease due to Israel's siege. The Integrated Food Security Phase classification warns the only path to stopping further deaths and catastrophic human suffering is for Israel to allow for the unimpeded, large-scale flow of humanitarian aid into Gaza. As Gaza's starvation crisis grows deeper for more than 2 million Palestinians living under Israel's siege, Republicans in the U.S. Congress are seeking to tighten a ban on the United Nations agency that until recently delivered humanitarian aid to Palestinians. Last week, the Republican-dominated House Appropriations Committee voted in favor of a package to slash foreign aid programs while tightening a financial blockade on the UN Reliefs and Works Agency for Palestinian Refugees in the Near East, known as UNRWA. Until Israel banned its operations in January, UNRWA was the main distributor of humanitarian aid in Gaza.
This is former Israeli spokesperson Elon Levy. In a video posted this week on X, blaming the United Nations for withholding aid to Gaza.
This is a monument to the catastrophic failure of the United Nations to deliver aid into Gaza. Hundreds upon hundreds of pallets of aid just rotting in the sun instead of being delivered to the people who need it.
For more, we begin today's show with UNRWA's Director of Communications, Julia Tuma, speaking to us from Amman, Jordan. Julia, thanks for joining us. Can you respond to Israel saying it's UNRWA, it's the United Nations that's stopping the flow of aid into Gaza?
Yeah, thanks for having me on. Look, for UNRWA, we have 6,000 trucks waiting for the green light, except they're not at Gaza's borders. They are in Jordan, where I am today, and they are in Egypt, loaded with medicines, food, and hygiene supplies. We've been waiting for a green light to start the wheels of those trucks for nearly 5 months now.
So could you describe, Juliet, what is the situation in Gaza, and when was the last time that UNRWA employees, former employees, international employees, were able to get in to the territory? Israel has been denying visas, we understand, for UNRWA employees.
We have 10,000 local Palestinian staff who work with UNRWA. They are spread across the Gaza Strip. They hold the fort while the international staff of the agency are banned from going into the war-torn enclave. They are the doctors and the nurses that keep our medical points open. They're the ones who are able to distribute whatever we have left of basic supplies. They're the drivers, they're the emergency operators who keep the shelters for the displaced families open. But we got to get in so that we can support them, and we got to get those trucks that are stranded in Jordan and Egypt in Gaza so that together we can distribute to starving people in the Gaza Strip.
And Juliet, for people who aren't familiar, if you could just outline the range of services that UNRWA used to provide within Gaza, the kind of humanitarian aid that was provided, and who's doing that now?
Sure. So before the war, the agency UNRWA was providing education to over 300,000 boys and girls who went to United Nations schools in the Gaza Strip. We also had over 20 clinics that provided primary health care to patients in the Gaza Strip. And we also gave, even before the war, because the humanitarian situation was already dire, we provided food for about a million people in Gaza. We do something similar in the occupied West Bank. But since the war began, we've shifted gears to do more humanitarian work. We've sadly had to close the schools. And as a result, soon in September, the children of Gaza would have been deprived of schooling for a third year in a row.
I wanted to ask you about a recent New York Times article that revealed, quote, according to two senior Israeli military officials, the Israeli military found no proof that Hamas was stealing aid provided by the United Nations. Israel has used these accusations for the past 2 years to restrict food and medical supplies from entering Gaza. Can you talk about the significance of this?
Oh, it's very significant. Thanks for bringing it up. And there was also a report from USAID that came out also a few days ago along the same line. And basically, you're absolutely right. This is a claim that the Israeli government and authorities and those who support them have repeated without any evidence that the humanitarian assistance that the United Nations was bringing in was diverted to Palestinian armed groups, which is absolutely baseless. And these two reports are a proof to that. Those claims were used simply to undermine the work of the United Nations, especially UNRWA. And we all know the disaster of this setup that the American and Israeli governments have put in place and the lives that organization has taken while claiming it provides food for people.
And Juliet, just finally, before we end, I just want to read from a statement that the head of UNRWA, Philippe Lazzarini, made. This is quoting colleagues of yours in Gaza who say that the people in Gaza, quote, are neither dead nor alive. They're walking corpses. So if you could say, Juliet, what are you calling for now?
We're calling for the siege to be lifted. We are calling for a standard and up volume flow of humanitarian assistance managed by the United Nations, including UNRWA. We're calling for a ceasefire. We are calling for the release of all hostages held in Gaza.
Julia Tuma, we want to thank you very much for being with us, Director of Communications for UNRWA, speaking to us from Amman, Jordan. When we come back, a doctor just back from Gaza joins us in our New York studio. Stay with us. So Among the Mountains by Nora Brown and Natalie Coleman at our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Mimi Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
As we continue our coverage of Gaza, a Palestinian medical organization reports Israeli forces are increasingly abducting doctors across Gaza, with some 28 doctors currently held in Israeli prisons. Among them is Dr. Marwan Al-Hams, head of Abu Yusuf Al-Najjar Hospital. He was last seen 10 days ago when an Israeli undercover unit seized him at a field hospital of the International Committee of the Red Cross in Rafah.
Well, our next guest is a U.S.-based surgeon just back from Gaza, where she treated patients at Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis, where she says malnutrition cases are everywhere, in newborn babies, pregnant women, even among the hospital staff. Dr. Amreen Slimi is a urogynecologist who is the executive director of the International Medical Response Foundation based here in New York City. Has provided medical services in numerous countries, including Pakistan, Nigeria, and Ukraine. She's joining us here in New York. Thanks so much, doctor, for joining us. You are just back this week from Gaza. Talk about what you found on the ground and the evidence that the Prime Minister of Israel is denying that there is starvation in Gaza.
Good morning. Thank you for having me here in New York. I just got back 2 days ago. And I spent about 3.5 weeks there, and primarily in the maternity hospital on the grounds of Nasser Hospital. And it was evident to me in my firsthand experience that what I was seeing was malnourishment in my patients, which were pregnant patients, but also those needing gynecologic care. And it was evident by the numbers of babies and their birth weight that was coming out, that they were being born to malnourished women. It was evident in the decreased ability to breastfeed when the newborns were born by the moms. And also in the way that pregnancies had complications that had increased in number, and remarkably so in the last few months of the siege. So there was ample evidence, just clinically by, you know, numbers in cases of complications, by birth weights of babies, by preterm babies, and also just being able to look at our patients, you know, to see bones that normally we wouldn't see. And we also saw it in our hospital staff, because not only were those being taken care of in a hospital starving with lack of access to good, nutritious food on a regular basis, but also the caregivers were also feeling the same lack of food, feeling the same hunger pains. And it was openly discussed, because everybody would sit and talk about how hungry they were in the break room, and when they were leaving, that they had to go now and find food for their families. So, you know, I think it was very clear in my experience and those I was working with that this was really a starvation crisis that was occurring.
And Dr. Slimi, you spent most of your time there in operating rooms. If you could talk about the intersection, the pregnant women that you dealt with who were also suffering from traumatic injuries. Yeah. What were the principal things that you were treating and the surgeries you were performing?
I'm really glad you asked that, because I think when we talk about pregnancy in a war zone, we really need to address the issue of trauma in pregnant patients. And actually, just before coming here, I found out that one of our pregnant patients who was in the ICU had passed away yesterday. And she was 5 months pregnant and sleeping in a tent, and a bomb was dropped in the area that's supposed to be a safe zone. So she ended up coming in with, extensive burns and explosive injuries with shrapnel, and required major surgery for the burns with skin grafts, major surgery, abdominal surgery to get rid of the shrapnel. She had lost vision in one eye, and she was intubated. She couldn't breathe on her own because of inhalation from the smoke and fire. So there was a thought that she would be able to pull through. Oh, and by the way, she was also 5 months pregnant, which was really hard to even notice because she was so malnourished. So I was consulted to come in and at least do an ultrasound and make sure that the baby was alive. And before I left, it was. And so I just found out yesterday, as I was checking up on her, I found out this morning that she had passed away. And there's always hope that somebody will pull through. But the situations with the sanitation in Nasser Hospital, we also just heard as we were leaving on Monday morning that the clinical wound services for over 400 patients had to be suspended because the supplies had run out. So we're already dealing with, you know, malnutrition and starvation because of the Israeli siege on food and supplies, affecting healing on a heavily traumatized patient population, including pregnant women. And now the services that were going to be withheld were the one thing that could get them to some healing with appropriate wound care.
I wanted to play for you the Israeli ambassador to the U.S., Yechiel Leiter, who claimed that the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was flooding food into Gaza. As we know, Netanyahu has denied outright that there's starvation in Gaza. This is the Israeli ambassador.
We feel the same way. The Prime Minister feels the same way, and that's why he's taken every decision possible to have food flood into Gaza. As a matter of fact, right now as we speak, there's 636 trucks, semi-trailers, waiting to enter Gaza, and the UN agencies are not picking them up because of their argument with the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation. I appeal to the international community, to the media. I mean, look, there have been pictures that have been broadcast, even on CNN, I gotta say this, excuse me, but even on CNN, pictures of children who are suffering from cerebral palsy or cystic fibrosis, not from hunger. And yet we're condemned for it. This has a long history of pointing the finger at the Jewish state and really has to stop.
So that was the Israeli ambassador speaking earlier. So, you know, the reference is to a New York Times cover story which showed the image of a child who appeared, in fact, was starving. But the Israelis said the story was misleading because the child actually had cerebral palsy. Now, Dr. Salimi, if you could explain, you know, that argument, respond to what was said now, but also the fact that that child had cerebral palsy. But first of all, cerebral palsy patients don't necessarily look so enormously emaciated. And you know, the claims that Israel is making about what's actually going on in Gaza.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting point that the government on one hand is saying one thing, and then in our experience, what we've seen firsthand as clinicians on the ground are seeing something completely different, that there is, you know, widespread starvation caused by the siege. We see it every day. We see it in our patients. And in children, not just with other conditions, but including cerebral palsy, they shouldn't be starving to death. So we have other children who don't have any other conditions who were also clearly starving from lack of nutritional food, and adults. And like I said, the caretakers that are supposed to be taking care of those who come in for care. I mean, how is this possible that they also are not getting nutritional food and starving and hungry?
And just to be clear, I mean, if you're suffering starvation and you get food, that doesn't mean you're going to be okay for the rest of your life. Can you talk right about the effect of starvation on children, on adults?
Sure. Based on what I know, again, it's not my area of expertise, but we know that many adults and children right now are in a stage five of the famine and starvation, and reintroducing food to a body that's been starved for months has to be done very carefully, and it can actually lead to somebody dying if it's not done appropriately, because you have lack of not just food. I mean, you can eat bread every day, but that's not enough to sustain development, healthy, you know, brain development, body development. And I think that's the thing that you'll see even in kids now after being deprived for months. The siege that's happening in the last few months is an acute event on top of a chronic, already malnourished population. So it's, you know, insults to injury. And again, these long-term effects of you know, developmental delay for kids. We see that. We know that's a possibility. How is it going to affect the adults long term when they do eventually get a steady supply of food? And I think that we know that there's going to be chronic health conditions.
You've also worked in Ukraine. We just have 30 seconds, but the comparisons.
I mean, they're both tragic situations. But one thing I'll say is I have worked in both, and as a humanitarian physician, feel that it's important that we work where we can, where the populations need it. But the one thing I can say for Gaza that is different is that there's no safe place in Gaza. We hear it all the time. Being there, it was absolutely, like, it was completely evident that there is no safe place in Gaza.
Dr. Ambreen Slimi, urogynecologist, executive director of the International Medical Response Foundation, just back this week from volunteering for several weeks at Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis in Gaza. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
On Wednesday, Canada became the latest country to announce plans to recognize a Palestinian state, joining recent calls by France and the UK. Prime Minister Mark Carney spoke in Ottawa.
Canada intends to recognize the state of Palestine at the 80th session of the United Nations General Assembly in September 2025. This intention is predicated on the Palestinian Authority's commitment to much-needed reforms, including commitments by the Palestinian Authority's President Abbas to fundamentally reform its governance, to hold general elections in 2026 in which Hamas can play no part, and to demilitarize the Palestinian state.
Israel blasted Canada's move, calling it a, quote, reward for Hamas. President Trump wrote on Truth Social, quote, that will make it very hard for us to make a trade deal with them. He was referring to Canada. Meanwhile, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, and Egypt and other Arab nations have joined a call for Hamas to disarm and end its rule in Gaza. The countries signed on to a joint call agreed to at a UN conference here in New York, co-hosted by Saudi Arabia and France, to build support for a two-state solution. For more, we're joined by Mohammed Shahada, writer and analyst from Gaza. He's in Copenhagen, visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations. Mohammed, welcome back to Democracy Now! Talk about these political developments, both the UK, France, Canada saying they're going to recognize Palestine as a state, and then Saudi Arabia, Egypt saying that Hamas has to disarm.
Absolutely. Thanks, Amy, for having me. The first thing to emphasize is that this is no way a reward for Hamas. It's actually, it proves hardliners within Hamas wrong when they say that nonviolence or advocacy do not work. Diplomatic engagement is futile and might make right violence is the only way. When you give Palestinian moderates a victory of this symbolic nature to argue with their hardline peers and say, look, there is an alternative path, this is in no way a reward for Hamas. What is actually a gift to hardliners is the Trump administration literally about 5 minutes ago imposing sanctions on Palestinian Authority officials, PLO officials, for trying to seek justice through the international court system, the Court of Justice and Criminal Court, and saying that this is a step too far. In terms of these promises of recognition, it's largely symbolic. It's filled with caveats, loopholes, and qualifiers and conditions. Countries that are deferring it until September, and some countries are saying we would recognize if Israel does not end the genocide in Gaza by then. But even then, even with these hesitant small steps, Israelis are saying this is dealing a significant amount of pain to the Israeli government. Yeah, Barak Ravid, one of the most prominent Israeli journalists, was saying yesterday that this is the worst diplomatic defeat Israel has suffered since its creation. And it is for three reasons. Number one, it's because the two-state solution is a conversation Israel does not want to have at all. Because once you begin to say, okay, let's move towards peace, Israel would see this as a peace offensive. That's literally a term that Israeli security strategist Avner Yaniv coined. And they would see it as a threat because that conversation would expose and lay bare who is the rejectionist party. Now you have consensus in the Israeli mainstream, wall to wall, including the opposition parties that are saying, like Yair Golan, Yair Lapid, Benny Gantz are saying there's not going to be any Palestinian state anytime soon. And you don't want to open that conversation because it is going to show that Israel is the one that's rejecting it. Like one of the reasons why Israel's propaganda is failing miserably, it's because Israel has gone too extreme that it became a political suicide for any Israeli diplomat or politician to even fake support for peace and the two-state solution. They would lose their jobs immediately. And the second reason is because Israel is trying to sell a fantasy of ethnic cleansing in Gaza and in the West Bank as the ultimate solution to the Palestinian question. to tell the Trump administration that the most humane thing we can do to Palestinians is to kick them all out of Gaza and turn it into a Riviera. But when you have countries that are saying, look, here's a solid political track that can end this occupation, end Israel's apartheid, allow both sides to live in peace, and that political track is endorsed by every single Palestinian political party, including Hamas. Hamas said, we will dismantle our arms, we will dismantle ourselves, lay down our arms if Israel ends the occupation. If you try to say, no, there is this alternative plan, Israel would be threatened by that. That's when even like Emmanuel Macron, the French president, he said in Singapore a month ago, he was saying something like, we will recognize Palestine on these multiple conditions, Hamas disarming, Hamas leaving Gaza, Hamas not having any political future. Israel panicked and immediately attacked him and called it a crusade because they see it as a threat. And the third fear is a snowballing effect. We see European governments that are saying recognition is not enough. It needs to be coupled with pressure on Israel, with sanctions, with penalizing measures to advance the Palestinian statehood to the end of the occupation. This morning, the Swedish prime minister, who is a right-wing coalition leader that is pro-Israeli for a very long time, was saying this morning, we need to impose these economic sanctions on Israel under the association agreement. So that's something that Israel is terrified of.
And so, Mohammed, you know, just to go back to the question of recognition, only to point out that the state of Palestine is recognized by 147 of the 193 UN member states. So, you know, if you could elaborate on, you know, the position that France, the UK and Canada have taken, the distinction between their position and the position the US is taking, because as you've pointed out, European governments have now moved from calling for the absolute destruction or dismantling of Hamas and Israel's right to do so, to calling on Hamas to hand over its weapons and ruling Gaza to the Palestinian Authority while leaving the door open for Hamas to join the PLO.
Absolutely, Nermeen, there's a significant shift here. European governments early on were saying Hamas needs to be dismantled, Hamas needs to be destroyed completely, and Israel has a right to do so. They now realized what the Trump administration has not come to realize yet. Trump and his team are still living in the fantasy that Hamas can be destroyed or it can be forced into surrendering. Whereas European governments are saying surrender is not going to happen, military defeat is not going to happen. The most extensive study in history on non-state armed actors was done by the Rand Corporation, I think in 2008, and they looked at groups like Hamas between the years 1968 until 2008, and they found that only 7% were defeated militarily, 43% through a political process. So that's why you see Western governments now saying that Hamas will not be forced into surrender, and Israel has failed to destroy Hamas militarily. The only way you can proceed forward is not a framework of capitulation, but one of decommissioning, like Northern Ireland, trying to get a process of Hamas disarming or laying down its arms hand in hand with a credible path towards Palestinian statehood. And that's what Israel sees as a threat, because Netanyahu is using it as a pretext to maintain an endless war in Gaza by saying we need to destroy Hamas while doing very close to nothing in that regard. They failed miserably. 22 months of unprecedented warfare in modern history since the Second World War, it did not defeat Hamas. But the pretext is still being used by the Israeli government, the Israeli military, to sustain the genocide in Gaza. So if you have countries that are offering them a way out, from a way to climb down from the tree, a way to disarm Hamas, of course Israel and the U.S. will react very harshly and in a very hostile manner to this.
It's been very interesting to see Trump disassociate himself from Netanyahu's remarks that there's no starvation in Gaza. Trump said otherwise. He saw the pictures, he said, on TV. They look hungry, he said. As he uses tariffs to attack countries politically, like he wants to protect the Bolsonaro in Brazil, who's on trial for attempting a coup, and he's going to impose 50% tariffs on Brazil, and attacks other countries like Canada for saying they're going to recognize a Palestinian state. What could he do when it comes to Israel? Of course, the U.S. has tremendous ties to Israel, providing massive amount of most of the weapons in Israel. If he really wanted to push Israel right now, after all, his negotiator, Witkoff, has just arrived in Israel, supposedly to jumpstart the so-called peace talks.
Well, there is this American perception that Netanyahu and Trump are very close allies and they love each other a lot. In Israeli media, which I read daily, you have a clear picture that Netanyahu and the Israeli government are terrified of Trump. They don't want to anger him. That's why as soon as Trump walked into office, Netanyahu immediately accepted the ceasefire proposal that's been on the table for 7 months or 6 months prior to Trump assuming office. He accepted immediately a temporary pause in Gaza, and then he tried to wiggle his way out of it. It's the same that you saw with Trump as soon as he wrote a single tweet telling Netanyahu, lay down your arms, stop bombing Iran. The ceasefire was stated immediately. And it's the same kind of pressure. All it would take is a single phone call from the Trump White House to Netanyahu and his government and saying, end the genocide in Gaza. But up until now, by the White House's own admission in Axios, Barak Ravid has been reporting on this, you see a consistency in the Trump White House of never trying to pressure Netanyahu at all on Gaza. At most, what they do is to tell him, the war is bad for you. You get to do whatever you want. We will keep giving you weapons and political cover and immunity. It's just not very good for your health. You make the right choice. And that is far from bringing a genocide to an end. The only thing it would take is Trump making a phone call to Netanyahu and saying, end this now. And that's something that Netanyahu is terrified about. Every time you see Trump making a statement that there is a breakthrough in the ceasefire negotiations in Gaza, you see Netanyahu taking a step back and allowing the Israeli team to go to Doha, to Qatar, and negotiate with Hamas until he bores Trump in the details and tires him mentally. And then the Israeli team is taken back, the blame is put on Hamas, and the genocide continues. It's the same dynamic over and over.
So, Mohammed, I just want to go to the comments that Trump made that perhaps were the most harsh in a way about the distance that he has, the position, his position, compared to Netanyahu's position. He responded to questions about starvation in Gaza while speaking to reporters on Air Force One earlier this week on Tuesday.
I think everybody, unless they're pretty cold-hearted or worse than that, nuts. There's nothing you can say other than it's terrible when you see the kids, and those are kids, you know, whether they talk starvation or not, those are kids that are starving. They are starving. And you see the mothers, they love them so much, and there's just nothing they seem to be able to do. They got to get them food, and we're going to get them food.
So, Mohammed, if you could respond very quickly to what Trump said and the fact that you've said a two-state solution, the conversation is basically dead in Israel. So what are they saying in the media there?
Well, basically, the Israeli fantasy is that Gazans are going to be pushed out and the West Bank would be next. Israel already started this process in Jenin and Tolkarem. Over 42,000 people displaced already there. So they think they can start it in Gaza and then replicate it in the rest of the Palestinian territory. But with hunger and Israeli propaganda about this, you see a pattern of Israeli propaganda going to the utmost extremes. Like with the GHF massacres, we saw it with our own eyes and ears on camera. We saw witness testimonies, Red Cross statements, Doctors Without Borders statements. And the Israeli talking point was, it never happened. Not just trying to minimize it, but to deny it altogether. And Israeli propaganda at this point, it does not aim to make the case for Israel or persuade you of what is right, but it's rather to sow confusion, flood the zone with as much confusion as possible to tire people out mentally, drain them and push them away from the topic under the pretext of, oh, it's too complicated to follow up on this. What you see with Trump is basically we've reached to a point of incontrovertible conclusive evidence of mass famine in Gaza, that you have the most notorious Republican pro-Israeli lawmakers that are admitting there is starvation happening there. So it reached the point of impossible deniability, but Israel is still at the point of saying, no, it's not happening. Don't believe your lying ears and eyes.
Mohammed Shahadawi, thank you so much for being with us, writer and analyst from Gaza in Copenhagen, visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations. Coming up next, as Trump's tariff deadline looms, August 1st, where do things stand on trade agreements? Stay with us.
Kiss me once, oh, kiss me twice. Give me a taste of paradise. I don't need the blues always on my shoulder. Give me a cold beer as I get older. Oh, stars, how you are to me. Oh, my stars. Oh, my stars.
Oh, my stars, by the late folk musician Michael Hurley, in our Democracy Now! Studio. To see our interview and his music here, go to democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. This is Democracy Now!
We turn now to trade. President Trump is standing by his August 1st deadline for trading partners to reach new trade agreements with the United States or face steep new country-specific tariffs. He posted on social media, quote, the August 1st deadline is the August on a trade deal with South Korea was also announced.
We turn now to Lori Wallach. Lori Wallach is the director of Rethink Trade, part of the American Economic Liberties Project. She's a board member of the Citizens Trade Campaign. Thanks so much for joining us, Lori. I mean, there is so much happening leading up to this August 1st deadline. Can you talk about what's most significant? The trade deals that are threatened, the ones that are being torn apart, the ones that are being reached between Trump and, for example, South Korea, now saying he's reconsidering Canada because they're considering a Palestinian state. What should we understand here?
I think the biggest takeaway is that what is actually being done by the president, Donald Trump, is the opposite of what candidate Donald Trump promised to attract working class voters, which was using tariffs and trade policy to rebalance trade, to rebuild our manufacturing, to create good jobs, making the things we need to be safe here at home. None of that is what's happening. Instead, first of all, you've got total random chaos. It's on, it's off. That's actually chilling investment. So some of the factories, new factories that were being constructed under the previous administration, the construction has been chilled because businesses have no idea what next week is going to be his whim. Number two, you're seeing this horrible combination of sort of Trump's own personal flattery, grudges, whims, and kind of like the George W. Trump administration as far as these deals, which are not written down, are unclear how real they are, but to the extent he's touting them, what we know about them is that, for instance, the big demands, the priorities are for big tech to get rid of other countries' anti-monopoly rules or privacy policies, for big pharma to raise medicine prices, for big oil to buy more U.S. carbon-based fuels. Meanwhile, on the actual trade front, we see the administration actually starting to cave in on the pre-existing Biden-era trade policies on China, because Trump so wants to have actually a summit meeting with the president of China and be flattered there. And then the places he is putting in tariffs, you mentioned this, the tariffs on Brazil actually went into effect yesterday. The highest tariffs we have, 50%. Why? Brazil, we have a trade surplus with. We export more stuff to them than we buy. This is not the country you'd want to be hitting with trade sanctions if you're trying to balance trade and build manufacturing. No, it's for what you said. Because President Trump sees failed couster Jair Bolsonaro, the former president, getting some justice in the courts and wants to beat on what could happen to him in the future, for instance. Or you heard a big announcement about new trade deals with the Europeans, with Japan, with Korea. That would roll back existing tariffs of 25% on imported vehicles, vehicles that we do know have a very low-wage supply chain. Each of those countries' other supply chain partners have low wages. Bulgaria for Europe, Southeast Asia, Cambodia, Vietnam for Japan, etc. Instead of conditioning, dropping tariffs from the existing, we have 25% tariffs, and some of this was during Biden, on imported autos. They drop them to 15%. Bad for domestic auto production, extract no higher wages, no labor rights. And here's the kicker, Amy, they have actually 25% tariffs on imported cars from North America, the one agreement that has enforceable labor standards.
Well, let's go, in fact, to the statement that the United Auto Workers released after the U.S. trade deal with Japan was announced. In a strongly worded statement, they wrote, quote, "The UAW is deeply angered by the Trump administration's announced trade deal with Japan. What we've seen so far makes one thing clear. American workers are once again being left behind." They go on to say, quote, "This deal hands a win to transnational automakers that rely on low road labor practices, substandard wages, excessive temps, and union busting. We need trade deals that raise standards, not reward the race to the bottom. This deal does the opposite," the UAW wrote. So if you could respond to that, Lori, and also I want to ask you about the piece that you wrote earlier this year for the American Prospect, in which you talked about the trade deals that we need. If you could say something about that.
So the UAW is spot on right, and they were reacting particularly to the trade agreement announced with Japan. But the exact same terms have just been hatched with the European Union and also with Korea. Those three trading partners they comprise the vast majority of what is an enormous U.S. trade deficit in automobiles and auto parts. So that actually is an area where there is a legitimate trade action under statute called Section 232 to try and actually fix that. So Trump has rolled that back, the existing penalty for trade cheating. And then the agreements he's made, so the UAW is spot on right. The agreements he's making is using the leverage of those tariffs that he has put in place or threatened to put in place to extract goodies for the usual Republican big corporate constituencies that has nothing to do with rebuilding jobs here or rebuilding our resilience by strengthening our manufacturing sector. And in the article that you can see in the American Prospect or on our website, rethinktrade.org, where we also have a tool that folks at home can use to test each of these agreements, where we basically have an assessor, an evaluator, so you can see here are the things that would be in a good agreement. These are things we need. This would help manufacturing, help balance trade, help U.S. workers, help workers around the world, versus here is stuff that is not in our interest, by the way, cheat. The stuff that's not in our interest has been the center of these agreements. What we need is trade policy being used in combination with other industrial policies so that we do need to rebalance trade. We have a $1 trillion trade deficit, as is a prediction of economic theory that has deindustrialized us. We can't make, as we saw during COVID, the basic things we need just to keep our families safe. In an era of climate chaos, we can't have everything made one place and schlepped across the world dumping carbon fuels. We need to diversify and have redundancy in production. All of those are policies that trade and tariffs can be a part of. But a lot of other tools have to be put in place to actually get the outcomes that you want. And what the Trump administration is doing, basically, is an abuse of the tariff tool. It's not using it for the kind of outcomes that could be strategic, but then using tariffs to threaten countries based on foreign policy whims based on a particular flattery goal.
Trump keeps saying, we're imposing this tariff on another country, what, 50% Brazil, whatever. Who actually pays? He suggests it's the country that's going to pay. But in fact, isn't it a tax on American consumers? And also talk about small businesses in this country right now falling apart.
Okay, so here is the thing about the tariffs, which is it is the case that who pays is typically negotiated. So the neoliberal line of it's just a tax, it always gets passed on the consumers, is not right. Trump's line of the other country's paying is not right. The true answer is it depends. And what the data is showing, Amy, from the beginning of the imposition of these tariffs is that right now, a lot of the foreign companies, to try and keep the U.S. business, because we do have a $1 trillion trade deficit, the whole world is overly reliant on dumping their stuff in this country. A lot of the other countries' companies are actually either splitting the costs with the U.S. companies or are eating the costs to be able to keep the market. So we have seen some real price gouging, where U.S. companies are raising prices, But in a lot of those instances, the actual price of the tariff, the cost, has already been absorbed by the company that's selling the stuff. So the U.S. companies are price gouging and ripping us off, but they're not necessarily doing that to pay for the tariff. So it depends on what the negotiated outcome is. Practically, the tariff is paid when it comes to the U.S., it goes into the U.S. Treasury. But who actually foots that bill is negotiated, and so far it's been a lot of the companies in the other countries. It's never the other governments, though. Trump is wrong about that. And as far as, you know, what...
We have 20 seconds.
As far as what we ought to do going forward, so Trump is not using trade policy in a way to help American workers to raise standards. That needs to be the goal. What we need to do is actually track the actual outcomes and hold him accountable, because politically it's super important. And again, our website at Rethink Trade has an evaluator everyone can use to test these agreements as they come out.
Lori Wallach, director of the Rethink Trade Program at the American Economic Liberties Project, board member of Citizens Trade Campaign, host of Rethinking Trade podcast. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. This is Democracy Now!
WRCT Pittsburgh.
You forgot to say who you are and with what band.
Yeah, I know. Hello, this is Reza from Le Vent du Nord. You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
Imagine home.